Why do you think people are so sensitive when it comes to talking about money?
Well, I think money is linked to your self-worth and self-esteem. It's linked to your general well-being. Money is often a measure of success, whether right or wrong, it is. And because of that, not everyone's happy to share the situation. Some people can talk up their situation, but behind the curtain, it's nowhere near what they portray it to be.
Hannah McQueen, the queen of money management and paying off your mortgage. Hannah is a financial force of nature, driven by a desire to make Kiwis smarter about money. A qualified accountant with a master's degree in taxation, she's the founder of the successful financial coaching firm, Enable Me. Hannah's also the author of the best-selling book, Kill Your Mortgage and Sort Your Retirement.
How do you know if someone is financially healthy?
That they can save at least 20% of their income. They're on track to be mortgage-free probably within a five-year period. That they know what they need for retirement and have a plan for it, and their kids are financially independent. Your beliefs, you know, like if your parents never talked about money, then you won't know how to talk about money, or if when they talk about money, it was always an argument, you're going to associate some pretty negative emotions with it. And if your or if your parents have told you that money is the root of all evil.
This is the Fresh Money Podcast.
74% of Pacifica, 56% of Māori feel unconfident or unsure when making financial decisions. This podcast is all about opening up the conversation of money and to help everyone get better at it. So if you can please like and subscribe, it's our promise to interview more people who can help and inspire you to become better with money. Please note that this podcast does not constitute financial advice. If you are needing financial advice, please consult a professional or get in touch and we can point you in the right direction. Talofa, Hannah, welcome to the Fresh Money Podcast, where we talk about all things money. You are a legend in my eyes. I've followed you for a long time, read all your books. You're the director and founder of Enable Me. Thank you for coming on Fresh Money.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Were you born being good with money?
No. I wasn't bad with money. Definitely a shopper. I grew up in a middle class Kiwi household where there were tight times, and my parents didn't really talk about it when it was tight, but you sensed it. My mum always managed the money well. She was kind of the person who managed it in our family, and Dad earned it, and Mum earned it as well. And I guess they didn't live large, so we were always comfortable, but you could feel those times when there was stress. Yes. I guess my relationship with money probably started, my conscious relationship with money probably started when I left home and went to university, and I've never been so poor in my life, and I didn't want to get a student loan, and I didn't quite qualify for the student allowance. And so I was sort of in this no man's land where you're working to have enough money to live on. And I remember going to the supermarket and I couldn't afford, I quite like peanut butter and jam on toast.
Nice.
And I went to buy jam and I couldn't afford the jam in the jar. I had to get the jam in the tin. Yeah. And I don't know where I was. And I just thought, we've got to change your trajectory, Hannah. Come on. But I guess I wasn't really exposed to how you create money and how you master your money. I just had some good principles to live by, but they weren't quite enough to translate to progress in the current environment that we find ourselves in. So I did my degree at university and got my master's.
Where'd you study?
Auckland. So I did commerce, and I'm kind of good with numbers and math, so majored in accounting and commercial law, then went on to do my master's in commercial law with a focus on tax.
Then, did you always have an interest in that area, or was it something you were just good at and so you
carried on? Good at.
Okay.
I was interested in law, not interested in accounting, but just that was sort of the path that I could see myself going down. And then graduated and worked at KPMG, which was probably my first real sense of a proper job, and learned a lot there. Remember my graduate salary was $32,000.
That's
great. But still not really progressing. So living comfortably within my means. I was actually married at that point, still married, but I was still quite young to be married. And my husband was sort of working a few jobs. He was studying a bit as well. And there's sort of the sense of there's enough money coming in, but not enough to actually start getting ahead. And it wasn't until we decided that we were going to try really hard to purchase a two-bedroom unit to live in that sort of focused our attention. But kind of worked through that. I was exposed to some learnings of how you make money with leverage and how you grow wealth. That sort of I became quite curious about understanding that in more detail. Yes. So kind of went down the route of trying to understand that to kind of pull it all together into how I could get ahead faster. And that then led to some pretty interesting insights that eventually led to me starting Enable Me.
And what was the thing that made you start Enable Me?
That I got fired from a job.
Did you?
Yeah, and I'm an accountant, right? So I'm a goody good. Like, I am a pleaser. I like everyone to like me. I like my boss to like me. Yeah. And I was talking to a friend who I was working with, and at this point we're actually working as brokers, mortgage brokers, because I wanted to understand how the lending worked, because lending's a core component of leverage.
Yes.
And I kind of wanted to see behind the curtain of how you maximise your ability to borrow.
Yep.
And anyway, a friend that I was working with came up with this idea. We were just talking, and she's like, instead of helping people get into debt, why don't we help them get out of debt? And I'm like, that is such a good idea, you know, like such an obvious idea.
Yes.
And we went to our boss at the time and said, this is this idea we've had, you know, would you be interested if we kind of headed up something in this space, obviously doing it under this particular brand.
Cool.
And he's like, what a great idea, write me up a business plan. So we wrote up a business plan and kind of trotted along to see him, and he's like, that's great. Now get out. You're fired. You're going into competition.
Really?
Like, what? I've played this so straight with them, you know, and
You're open with
them up front. And genuinely wanted to do it with them. So not only were you transparent, but you're inclusive. Mm. And it was so bad. And, yeah, so then we were fired, and I remember packing my stuff up into a box and waddling out of there, and I was just like, what an epic fail.
Yeah, wow.
But that was sort of the catalyst to, okay, well, I actually am quite serious about helping people. There's got to be more to it. So then I reflect, and it's easy to do this when you're sort of at the bottom of the heap, or in a heap. That's when I thought, okay, well, most people getting ahead, they think they need to earn good money, but I'm earning good money relatively, and I'm still not getting ahead, and I live within my means, and I kind of do all these things that we're taught normally by our grandparents and then parents to do, but it's still not translating. And so I'm like, why is that? I mean, I can write a budget, I can colour code a budget, but I just don't really stick to a budget. And so that was, I guess, this awareness that my relationship with money or your psychology of spending has more of an impact or a bigger indicator of what you will achieve, more so than your income levels.
Interesting.
So then I made a couple of phone calls, and we had our little mortgage at that point. It was $350,000. And I did what everyone had done in this process, like you play the banks off against each other to get the best deal.
Yep.
But I was still going to pay $1 million back to the bank. And this, so $350,000 mortgage, almost three times that in lending, repayments. And this interest rate discount that we're sort of excited by was going to save me $12,000 out of the million. So I'm like, that's not, I mean, yeah, I'll take it, but it's not that exciting. And so then I'm like, okay, well, I need to be able to pay my mortgage off faster to, or shorten the term, so pay it off faster. And I'm like, yeah, but there are some months I can't even comfortably make the minimum repayment. Yeah, so the idea of committing to a shorter term felt a bit reckless. And then you're like, well, I could pay off the mortgage at some point during the year, like make an extra payment, but how do I do that? And some of the banks say, well, you can have it on, you make a lump sum payment without penalty. Yes. And I'm like, that's cool. But what if I want to do a bit more? And they're like, well, you could have a portion of the mortgage on a floating rate. And I'm like, yeah, but that's 1.5% higher than a fixed rate. So why would I do that? And at what point does it no longer benefit me?
Yeah,
and
true.
Kind of all these things. And so that triggered me then calling the calculus department of the University of Auckland and asked one of their math tutors if they would help me work on the formula to structure my mortgage so it could be paid off as quickly as possible at the lowest cost, maintaining maximum flexibility. Because I didn't want my mortgage to dictate how I had to live my life.
Yeah.
A few months later, 8 pages of calculus later, I had this formula that would save me the size of my mortgage in interest costs. So $350,000, and I patented that formula. But for the formula to work, I had to work out how I could get money left over. Like, okay, I was earning good income, but I still had no money left over. So it was sort of like, well.
So there has to be a surplus.
There has to be a surplus. And how can I maximise that when I'm a shopper to still want to stick to that plan? Because anyone can kind of go hard for a few weeks or a couple of months. But you're talking consistently delivering above the odds. Unless you can have the system to make that effortless, it's going to feel like you're on a financial detox, which
always kind of rebound back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's actually how I started Enable Me, because after I had that formula, I thought, okay, well, let's start to understand behavioural economics. So why people do what they do with money, even when they know they shouldn't or don't want to, but they still find themselves kind of sabotaging their own behaviour. And that is what led to us designing different strategies for different behaviours.
Interesting. Because is it more behaviours as opposed to math?
Yes. To start with, you've got to get the you've got to master the behaviours to have the right strategy.
Mm.
Then we've got to work out what's our wealth creation plan or strategy.
Okay.
And that's all numbers, like, because it's kind of scientific. If I want $300,000 of gain, how am I going to get that? And that's going to help me become mortgage-free faster or sort retirement or whatever the case is. So it does come down to the science of numbers eventually, but the first step is the behaviours, and that's where most people come unstuck. They get excited about the science, and it's like, you're worried about something you can't even benefit from. Let's master the behaviours first.
Crazy. And that's what you do at Enable Me. And you have personal financial trainers?
Yeah, we call them financial personal trainers. Yep. Yeah. And they are qualified financial advisors, and their job is to maximize your surplus and to get your money working as hard as possible. And we're a team now of financial advisors in that space, probably about 50 of us.
Okay.
But part of a wider team that look at things beyond property and mortgages of just over 100.
Oh, wow. Mm. Wow. And is there a cost to that?
Yes. Yeah, so if you work with us, depending on how long you work with us for, depending on what you're trying to achieve and how ambitious you are wanting to be and therefore want us to support you to be, the fees can range from $1,500 a year through to $12,000 a year,
great.
So quite extensive.
Yep.
The ones at the higher end, they're normally wanting to be mortgage-free in under 5 years, want to probably triple their cash surplus and want to purchase a couple of investment properties that they want us to find for them as well. So that's sort of a big year, whereas at the smaller end, they just want to get in control of their money. They want a plan. They want support. If either their own relationship with money isn't particularly healthy or between them and their partner, it's really hard for them to navigate that. Mm. And I think sometimes it's you're wanting to take advice on board, but you need to hear it from the right person in order for you to engage with it.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I'm wanting to get fit, my husband's really fit, naturally fit, annoyingly fit. Mm-hmm. And if I kind of, he could give me advice on how to be fit. He's qualified to do it.
Yep.
But if he kind of suggests anything,
yes,
I'm kind of
yes.
offended.
Yeah.
Even if I've asked him for feedback. And so I think so much of life is having, especially finance, is being self-aware enough to determine who do you need to hear it from to just take it on board. Because it's not supposed to create like this anxiety in you or this offence. It's just there isn't supposed to be emotion on this. It's just it's a very emotional topic.
Yes.
And your partner can make it more so, right?
Yeah, for sure. We had Stacey Morrison on earlier, and she said that it was just a great way to have someone who was separate from the relationship, and just it wasn't, they weren't on your team or the other person's team. It was the coach was there, the trainer was there to help you both win, essentially.
Yes.
Yeah, and understand both.
Team Morrison.
So she said it was really cool that it was impartial in a way.
Yeah, and I think with that impartiality, you are able to be more direct than what you might otherwise be. Because when you know the people too well, you're very conscious about perceived biases or creating offence. So we look at the most common bits of feedback we get from clients, and there are three, which is the first one is, I wish I'd started working with you years ago. I'm sleeping so much better because obviously financial stress is one of the main causes of insomnia. And I can't believe you got away with saying that to my spouse. Because sometimes people are prepared to hear it, but it's got to be from the right person.
Wow. What's the most challenging thing about running a financial service provider?
I think growth is hard. We have always believed in organic growth, so we will grow as naturally. We won't acquire businesses and we're not going to take on debt to grow. So you become very good at creating good customer outcomes because that's what leads to more income, incoming customers.
Through word of mouth.
So I guess one of the things I'm most proud of is we don't endorse a particular product, you know, so we're not aligned to a bank, we're not aligned to an investment type or an insurance or whatever. We're not aligned to any provider. We're just there to provide the right strategy and to work with professionals if that's appropriate, or to do it if we don't have the professionals. But I think that not always, but a lot of financial advice can be, it can be conflicted. If one person's only got one particular product to sell. KiwiSaver would be an example, right? Like you go to a KiwiSaver provider, well, they can only talk to you about the products that their business sells. And you're like, well, I actually want to know how that compares to the rest of the market, compared to your products. And I think there is there's a lack of objectivity with some of those comparisons in the market. Mm. So I've always tried to be independent.
Awesome.
And because of that, it's easier to charge a fee because you're bringing kind of independent or objective value.
How do you know if someone is financially healthy? What are the key indicators?
That they can save at least 20% of their income. That they've got, they're on track to be mortgage-free probably within a five-year period. That they know what they need for retirement and have a plan for it. And their kids are financially independent. And they don't need to have ticked all of those boxes, but they are on a journey to have all those boxes ticked. Other measures could be that you sleep well, you don't worry about money. Money's kind of neither good nor bad, but it just should be mastered. And I think you know if you've mastered it. But most people, to be honest, don't even know what their take-home pay is. They don't really know how much they save. Like one of the first questions I ask clients is, well, how much did you save in the last 12 months? Because that's sort of an indicator as to how healthy they are. And most people either don't know or it's not much. So they know, but it's I can answer that question. It's nothing. It's like, okay, well, good on you for knowing, but the answer's
not really
good.
Knowing.
I just think that money creates a lot of angst. And in trying to change behaviours, which is what we do before we get to the science of creating wealth, those behaviours go back to your how you've been taught about money,
your
beliefs. You know, like if
That's
your parents never talked about money, then you won't know how to talk about money. Or if when they talked about money, it was always an argument, you're going to associate some pretty negative emotions with it. Mm. And if your or if your parents have told you that money is the root of all evil, which isn't quite what the scripture says. Mm. It's the love of money, not money itself.
Yes.
Then you might have quite an unhealthy kind of perspective on money, or if you don't think you're worthy enough of growing money, then you're not going to try, right? So there's sort of all of that. Parents aren't necessarily consciously telling you these things.
Yeah.
They might even be trying to tell you the opposite, but their behaviours are actually embedding quite a negative relationship in for you. And that, along with kind of your first big money decisions, sends you on a course.
That's
right. It doesn't take much to be kind of 1 or 2 degrees off course, and you can end up in a very different destination.
Yeah, for me, growing up with no money, it pushed me into sprinting to learn about it because I didn't want to rerun that tape for me and my kids.
Yes.
So I had to unlearn a whole lot of things that I didn't know that I had learnt just through a kind of osmosis, being around my parents.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's super important to be firstly aware of that you have those inherent behaviours from your parents, and secondly, knowing if they were good or bad.
I know.
Yeah.
That's right.
Because a lot of people get financial advice from family.
Yeah.
And some people don't know whether it's good or bad.
Yeah, family or YouTube, right? And both are normally just as dangerous. Because it's either immersed in that person's perspective, right? Like they're conditioned a particular way, or it's interpreted a particular way because of some of that conditioning. It can be quite dangerous, but common.
Yeah. What is, in your books, you talk about money personalities.
Mm.
Can you explain a bit about what those are?
Yeah. So when you're trying to change behaviours, the least amount of friction you create, the easier something is to do.
Mm.
It's sort of the argument. And so if you can understand what you are, best you play to what you are, because that will be easier for you rather than not. But depending on what you are, there will be particular strategies to bring out the good of that or to try and curb the negative.
Okay.
So if we think about your situation, you will have a spending tendency. You will either find it easier to spend or to save.
Okay.
It's neither good nor bad, it just is a thing. And you'll know instinctively. So someone...
I'm a spender.
Yeah, I'm a spender as well. So it's not that we can't save. We can.
Mm.
We just need a reason to save. And if we don't have a reason, we just find it easier to spend. So the best thing for me is just don't have money in my bank account. And I don't care if I won't spend if I don't have the money, but if it's there, I'll be quite relaxed. And I think that's the problem is as people earn more money, they become more relaxed with their money as opposed to more deliberate. So what should have been an advantage just sort of becomes a nothing.
Yeah.
So back to your spending tendencies. So a shopper or a spender is someone who just finds it easier to spend, not necessarily on themselves, not necessarily big things, could be little things often for other people, but you're still a spender.
Yep.
A saver is the opposite. They find it easier to save. They need a reason to spend, and in the absence of a reason, they just find it easier to save.
Yep.
And without a doubt, if you're that person, that is an advantage, right? Like you're naturally tight. I mean, awesome. It gets interesting when you overlay what their partner's tendency is. So the spender-spender combo, they are looking good, they're lots of fun, but they're probably going nowhere. Or the saver-saver combo, they're just tight.
Yeah.
And within every group of friends, you've got, you know, that saver.
Definitely.
And you know if you're a spender because when there are some really good things they do, you just like, this is so embarrassing. So like if a saver is the type of person who will bring out a discount book, which as a spender, you're like, put that thing away. This is embarrassing.
Yeah,
but that's actually a really good behaviour, right?
Is,
but it's just not natural to us spenders.
Yep.
And so then you get the saver-spender combo where I guess the advantage of the saver is kind of negated by the spender who doesn't feel like they can spend, but nor are they saving to the degree they could have. And so no one's happy really under that arrangement. So that's the first layer. And then the next layer is, well, how ambitious are you? So you're either quite conservative or you're ambitious. And if you're conservative, you're most likely to be a saver. So you're good at not spending, but you don't take risk with investment. So you had the advantage on one hand, but then the next layer, you're a bit useless. Whereas the spender is useless at saving, but they tend to be more ambitious. Like they need a big goal, otherwise they can't be bothered saving. But if you give them the big goal, they're all in.
Yep.
They're great. So we're trying to balance that, and there's sort of more layers to how we think about those strategies. So we've got to understand your spending tendencies and your level of ambition, and then we've got to overlay, and what do you have to work with? Because some people have nothing when they're starting, and some people have a lot, and depending on what you've got to work with depends on what the next course of action would be. And then how much, if you were to describe your cash position, are you sinking or are you floating or are you flying? Those are kind of the fundamentals. If we can understand that, then I can work out the strategy.
Okay.
And normally for spenders, useless at saving, but very good at paying down debt and growing wealth. Savers are great at saving, but useless at growing wealth. So it's just trying to balance those to get the best out of everyone.
Yeah. Mm. And my wife is a saver. Mm. And you're 100% right, because I'm the one probably who has a bit more understanding of investment. And so I'm more likely to take those types of risks to invest our surplus, but as long as I take her along with the journey.
Yeah,
and she understands. If I can explain it to her in 10 words or less and she gets it, then
it's all systems go.
Yeah. With the cost of living crisis and inflation at, was it an all-time high? It's on the way down a bit. Is it tricky at the moment for people to get ahead at the moment?
Yes, it is. I guess if you think of the economic cycle, like seasons, we're in winter where it's barren, and we're starting to see the first shoots of spring.
Yeah.
But you've got to be able to hold through a winter. And I think a lot of people didn't build up enough stores in autumn to survive through the winter, and they are doing it tough.
Yep.
And then with spring comes opportunity. There'll be some people who won't be ready for that opportunity, and so they will perpetuate this feeling of, I'm always on the back foot, I'm always chasing something instead of being ready to go. So what we know is that when you have a big pruning session with your finances, the next step in that process, or even an economic cycle, is growth. And so the idea is, if we can hold during winter without going backwards, when the spring comes, you jump ahead. But if you've started to go backwards in winter, all the spring does is allow you to catch up rather than get ahead. And for some people, they are always on this treadmill of, I'm just trying to catch up. I'll catch up it soon. I'll catch up soon. And we have to break that. We have to create a circuit breaker, because that will be for the rest of their lives. They'll be trying to catch up. They'll never quite have enough. And correcting that is hard, and it requires an investment of the person in themselves as much as anything else.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So a circuit breaker, do you mean seeing an app?
You could come and see me, or you could have your come to Jesus moment, but this reflection of, I don't want to do it like this anymore. There's got to be a better way, and then determining who's going to help you on that path.
Yeah, what would you say to people who are, in this kind of winter holding pattern, people who are cutting things out, like, important things like, insurance and things like that? Yeah. What would you say to them?
Well, it's pretty bad if you've got to get rid of those costs. And I guess there's a highlight of, we're not in control of our money, so what are we going to be doing differently? And a lot of people will just relax when spring comes, as opposed to use that as an opportunity to get ahead. I think the conditions have been really hard. But when the conditions are hard, that means you have to be better. And a lot of people don't know how to be better. So it's about equipping them with the the right behaviours and tools and strategies so that they can be.
If you have kids, when should you be talking to them about money?
I think you said, when should you have kids?
Oh.
The science behind money in kids, I think we should be starting kind of from age 3, 4, or 5, but it's got to be age-appropriate lessons. And if we kind of work all the way backwards, from 17, they're going to be making, age 17, they're going to be making probably the biggest financial decisions of their lives. And if they're going to go down through a university route or more tertiary learning, potentially incurring a student loan, which has huge ramifications to their mindset around money, how quickly they can buy a house,
kind of all these things. True.
And most Kiwis just, or most adolescents just sleepwalk into that, not even realising that they are tilting themselves in a particular direction, which will have more of an indication of how quickly they'll get ahead than they realise. So working backwards from there, with my, I did a lot of research on this and actually wrote a book on how you get your kids financially independent to make these decisions, and it goes right back to, we've got to start young because there's so much that they need to learn, and we've got to kind of build on the concepts so that they are equipped by the time that they are 17. So they know how to earn money, they know how to manage their money, and they know how to grow wealth. They know the difference between good debt and bad debt. They know what their student loan's going to cost. They're going to know how quickly they can pay it off, what the job is that they're going to be able to get from that student loan, when they can buy a property. They need their life designed by that age, but for them to be able to understand that, there's just a lot of complexity that we've just need to get the basics in place.
Yeah.
And the problem is, and I've got a 16-year-old, that they don't want to hear it from you as the parent. They need to hear it from someone, so someone's got to be able to teach them. So I actually work with a lot of the children of my clients, helping them get ready for that next transition. Or I get the kids to come along to their parents' meeting. So at the very least, they understand that financial success is deliberate. And mum and dad are successful with money, but they are putting in the effort, focusing on the right things, climbing the right mountain to make sure that they get those outcomes. Yep. I think so often people put effort in, but they've put the effort in to climb the wrong mountain. Mm-hmm. That was a waste of effort.
Yeah.
So, for example, I had this client and she's like, she had a little bit of money to invest and she was trying to work out where she should put that money from a term deposit perspective, which bank she should put with.
Yep.
Put that with, and she did, I don't know, about 3 hours of research, just comparing it all. And kind of good on her for doing that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, and she emailed me, she said, I've got it, I know what I'm going to do. But well done. The impact of that effort was going to create maybe an extra $20 to her over 6 months. Mm. It's like, who cares?
Yeah.
That, for me, that is a waste of effort. Just don't buy a coffee for three
days
and it'd be a whole lot easier,
right? I was just
going to
say, it's a couple of coffees.
And so I think so often people put effort into saving money, but the saving is so minuscule. You're just like, we're missing the picture if we're focusing in that much detail, but there's sort of chaos all around.
Yeah, so true. Mm-hmm. You touched on teens before. I get asked this question all the time. Should you buy your teenager a car?
Well, it's an interesting conversation we're having in our house
I am too.
Well, some say that the car purchase is the first big purchase that your kids make. And then others say you don't want your kids buying a car that's not appropriate or is dangerous.
There's so many reasons for and against it.
Yeah, I think at the very least what we're wanting your kids to have experienced before they leave home is saving for something big.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't have to be the car, but something big. We need them to experience the process of that, the delayed gratification.
Yeah, true.
The excitement, the reward. And the cars tend to be so much bigger than anything else that they have spent before. So that there's often a year or 18 months going into achieving that goal. Mm. I don't know if it needs to be the car, but you've got to find another goal that they can have.
Yeah, yeah. Because
for me and my wife, driving our kids around to the sports is annoying.
Yeah.
It'd just be easier if I bought them a car.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. And yeah, it's so the conversation we had is, oh, but all my other friends' parents bought a car for them. And I'm like, so?
Yeah.
Like, I don't get the connection.
I walked to everything when I was a teenager.
Yeah, yeah. And exactly. Then my husband comes in and it's like, oh, I was a kid. And then you just see, oh, God. Look, you just want your kids to thrive.
Mm.
And I think one of the hardest things as a parent, especially when you're in a position to be generous with your kids, that almost brings joy to you being able to give some of these things.
Yeah, it
and
does.
You have worked hard and you've done it for them. Not that they ever appreciate it, but you kind of
But it's part of the reason why you work hard.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so
the enjoyment of spending it on them.
Correct. So we've got to be able to still give you that satisfaction, but not for them to lose the lesson that they otherwise could have got. So it just means we've got to be deliberate with how we create that lesson.
Okay, cool. That's great. Thank you. Financial stress is one of the key reasons for relationships to break up, unfortunately. When should you start that convo about of money with your partner? Should you do a credit check right at the start?
Yeah, I think that money permeates through everything.
Mm.
And when you think about what's important in life, you're like, well, you've got to get your soul right. kind of have your beliefs there, and your health are probably the two most important things.
Yep.
And family is sort of within that, probably connected to the soul and health. But then underneath that, then money is kind of one of the next things.
Yep.
So it's quite important. Certainly in the top five, getting your money sorted is key. The problem is people don't know how to start a conversation around money. And so when you're courting your partner, that is when you want to be asking some of those questions. But that's hard, right?
And, it is.
And even if they're useless with money, that doesn't mean that they're a terrible partner, but it can be helpful to know that that's probably going to be one of your earlier challenges in the relationship. And how are we going to navigate that?
That's a great point.
But when you're...
Because you don't want it to be this interrogation, but you
no.
want to you to understand and understand them as well.
That's right. Yeah. And if that's an area where they're limited in their understanding or confidence, then knowing it's helpful. But, I mean, there's just so many things to get to know when you're getting to know them. And if I think of my own situation, like my husband and I got married quite young. Like I was 18 when we got married.
Yeah.
At that time, neither of us would have known what our money personalities were, right? You know, like apart from the fact he probably would say, well, you clearly have a silver spoon in your mouth. Apart from that, we could see that we had grown up in different worlds. Mm. He definitely had come from a poorer background than what I had, but I would say that I was still middle New Zealand, like I wasn't wealthy. I guess there's some insight there. You can see how resourceful they are and how flippant they are with money. My observation to my husband was probably that he managed his money well, and I probably thought he was a really hard worker more than anything. That was probably all I could have gleaned at 18. And I don't know if my brain could have coped with much more. There were sort of other things you're trying to cope with, but... Yeah, it's if you're starting off right at the start of a pretty wholesome relationship, it's hard to kind of integrate money when you don't yet have your money stories.
Mm.
Maybe look at the parents as an indicator.
True.
And that doesn't mean that you can't change anything. I think it's important
to understand that. Because sometimes you grow together, right?
That's right. But to know that some effort's going to need to be put into changing that trajectory is helpful for you both to acknowledge.
The goal of this podcast is to talk about money.
Yeah.
Why do you think people are so sensitive when it comes to talking about money?
Well, I think money is linked to your self-worth and self-esteem. It's linked to your general well-being. Money is often a measure of success, whether right or wrong it is.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, not everyone's happy to share their situation.
Yeah.
I think people also... some people can talk up their situation, but behind the curtain, it's nowhere near what they portray it to be.
Yep.
Often frivolity is funded from debt as opposed to wealth.
Yeah.
But I think it's people just don't talk about it honestly, so it's hard to know where to start.
True. And what are the most common mistakes you've seen people make with money?
That to be successful, you need to earn more money. I think the problem is that you just spend more, so you're still no better off. Yep. All you've done is created more stress for yourself in a day job, right? So I think that's a problem. I don't think it's possible to drift towards financial success anymore. I think for my grandparents' generation, it was.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you weren't bad with money and owned a property quite early on, you were going to be okay.
Yeah.
And it was almost impossible to be bad with money because there was no such thing as credit cards then. There weren't even cafes, right? There was nothing to spend money on, and you couldn't spend more than you earned. So being good with money, you'd almost have to be a gambler in those days to be bad with money. So for the majority of people, they could live within their means.
Yeah. And almost forced upon.
Exactly. There was no alternative. You couldn't spend it on anything else. And then you, from owning a house, well, their houses cost 2 times their income, whereas now it's like 7 times your income. So the conditions were just easier. And admittedly, they had to go to war and do all those other things, so there were some trade-offs.
Yeah.
But the conditions were easier than what we find them to be. Okay. And when it's harder, you've got to be better. And it's like, well, it's definitely harder, but in addition to that, we're worse. You know, so we're not particularly good with money. We're quite relaxed.
The behaviours that have
come
out of
the behaviours have worsened, not improved, and the conditions are harder. So it's like, well, that's sort of like a double bad.
Yeah.
But it can surprise people what can be achieved when I can show them the sum of all their inefficiencies. And they won't. None of my clients are particularly bad at anything.
Yeah.
And so they incorrectly conclude, well, I can't see where I'm bad, therefore I can't see how I could be any better. You know, so they can't see that connection. And so then they don't bother doing anything. But when they come to me, I'm like, well, no, you're not bad, but we're inefficient here, there, and here. We're going to pull that together and the compounded impact of that. Well, I aim for it to be $1 million of difference over 10 years, right? And I sort of need it to be that big because often my clients are shoppers like me. I've got to make it worth their while if I want them to put effort in. Because I wouldn't put effort into anything unless it was worth my while. Because that would be stupid, right? Like, whether it's getting fit, well, I want to see that I'm getting fitter. Yes.
You want to see the progress.
Exactly. Yep. Otherwise, why bother? Yep. You know, like there are so many other things we could do. And I think if we took a similar approach to money, it would just sort of break down some of the misunderstandings. If you want to see progress, well, let's make sure you see progress. And if you're not seeing progress, then I don't care how much effort you're putting in. It's the wrong effort or you're focusing on the wrong thing.
True.
And let's channel that in the right direction.
Yeah, wow. How much savings should people have in their bank account for a rainy day? Yeah,
well, the rough rule of thumb is around you should have access to around 3 months of fixed living costs. Which whether you have that, it doesn't have to be in savings. It could be in access to a credit card.
Oh, okay.
It could be access to a line of credit or knowing that you could bail the bank of mum and dad up. Like it doesn't have to be as tactile as having a savings in a separate bank account. That's probably an unproductive way to have those savings.
Yep.
But I do think that COVID showed a lot of us that when you don't have the ability to spend because there aren't any shops open, that your living costs drop. Like that's where most of us saved during that time because they couldn't spend.
Save.
Yeah, well, look at that. It's just balancing those things.
And how quickly does Enable Me get your clients to pay off a home loan?
It depends.
Is there
we've got formulas that we work to.
Okay.
And so it depends on your household income and the size of your debt. We've got kind of some rough guidelines that we work to. So if your household income was $100,000, and your debt was $400,000, so that's between everyone in the household, debt $400,000, that's a 1-to-4 ratio. We'd expect to get you mortgage free in 8 years following our methodology. So that's sort of how it would flow through.
Wow.
If it's 1 to 3, we would say about 5 years. And if your ratio is 1 to 5, we'd say 10 to 12 years. And if it's more than that, we would be saying we need a difference, we need a strategy in addition to being better with money to to bring it back down. Or you need to sell your house and change.
Okay. Oh, okay. And restructure the whole, or start again.
Yeah.
What's the biggest barrier for people to pay off their home loan?
Their own behaviours. Yeah, most of my clients, their situation is just comfortably inefficient. Their own behaviours are just, they're not
Are they
bad.
Aware of those? Or
Yeah, but they're not aware of the compounded impact.
Oh, okay. The,
and the leveraged result. So they don't think it's all that bad. It's sort of, you've got to almost apply the logic with food or exercise. You know, most of us consume more sugar than what we realise. And it's not that we think that we're bad with sugar. It's just, yeah, maybe I could improve. But I think when we start to break down some of the sugar in people's finances, it will surprise them that where they're consuming the inefficiencies.
Mm. You know, talked about it being trickier in some ways to get ahead today. Mm. What's the best kind of tip you would give someone who's looking to get on the property ladder today?
Well, I think getting onto the property ladder, whether it's to be your first home or an investment property, is probably the single biggest milestone you should have. Mm. It probably needs to be an investment property rather than a home, because with those changing conditions compared to our grandparents, buying your first home is, for many young people, will actually grind all progress to a halt, because their mortgage size will be too big for their income, and they'll be able to afford it. It's not that they won't be able to afford it, but they won't be able to afford to do anything else. And so their ability to become mortgage-free faster, they kind of shoot themselves in the foot with that, because they just tap everything out.
Yeah, wow.
So getting onto the ladder, the property ladder, is important. And when we work with clients, our objective is to have them on that ladder, ideally within a 12-month period.
Cool.
Because we've got to go hard. Now, whether that means it's through syndication or co-ownership versus outright ownership is sort of another thing that we would explore with them, but it's to push them forward.
And if I had $100,000 today, where should I invest that?
We'd want to buy an investment property. We'd want to, arguably, you could buy kind of a $500,000 or $600,000 property with that. Depending on how much you could save between now and when the property settles, we might even be able to get it to $700,000. We ideally want it in a high growth area. I guess if I'd sit backwards, I'd say, well, within the next 5 years, I'd like to turn that $100,000 into $300,000 or $400,000 of growth. So that's sort of the objective.
Yep.
So which investment strategy is going to allow me to do that? So we could put it in the bank, you could put it into a managed fund or the share market, or we put it into property.
Sure.
And property will outperform those other assets materially by hundreds of percent. But you have to be able to afford to hold the property until we get that gain. And that's where a lot of people come unstuck. They firstly don't buy the right property to give them that gain, and then they get burnt in that process because interest rates go up or whatever the case is, and you sell before you made the money, and that's the challenge.
What's the right property? What do you mean by that?
Well, when I don't believe in doing anything for the sake of it. So if I'm going to be growing wealth, I'm trying to determine how much wealth am I trying to create and within what time frame. So if it was, I need to create $300,000 of gain within 5 years, I work out, well, what is the growth rate I need on my investment to give me that gain? And then based on that growth rate, that will tell me, well, what are the regions I should invest in? Because they all regions go up at a different pace.
Yes.
And types of property go up at a different pace. So if you've got a standalone property or a townhouse, which tends to be attached normally through the roof, or an apartment, they all go up in value, but they go up in value at different paces.
Yeah. Yep.
The number of bedrooms determines how much the rent you will get, and the rent you get will determine how much you need to put in of your own money each week.
Yep.
And so you're sort of trying to balance all of these things to work out what's going to give you the best overall outcome.
Mm.
From your experience and seeing so many clients over the years, what is the key factor that you see in clients that determines that they'll be successful in building wealth?
Are they ready for change? And only they can answer that. But my job is to quantify the improvement they could get before they make the decision if they're ready. Because a lot of people have dismissed that there's any improvement to be had. So they'll be like, well, why would I put effort in just to go nowhere? And I understand that logic. But, I mean, I've joined a gym before and not turned up. So I know that it's possible to want an outcome but not really be committed to any of the
just
process.
Just making a donation to the gym.
Exactly. And so I think, you know, when you're ready and it's game on. And I think the fastest way to embed that is to get really quick results so that you feel the momentum of success. So for the first 12 weeks that I work with clients, I'm like, do everything that I say and I guarantee an outcome. This will be the outcome in dollar terms.
Yeah, cool.
And then we're tracking to that. It's the clients that are the – if you do everything that I say, I will guarantee an outcome.
Awesome. For businesses at the moment, what should they be doing?
Well, a business is hard. And one of the reasons why business is hard is because you have volatility of income. And that volatility, whether it's good or bad, creates, it impacts your liquidity in the business. And it makes it hard to predict what you will achieve. And when you don't know what you will achieve, you run the risks of not aiming for anything and you can't predict. And if you can't predict, you can't then maximise. So often the difference between a good outcome and a bad outcome in business, in life, but business especially, is to do with timing and your ability to access cash. If you could access cash at the right time, then you would be able to smooth your results out. But when you don't have that or line of sight on that, you can't take advantage of forward planning. It's so you're reactive to everything and anything. So, and also the problem with business is it's really difficult to borrow to try and smooth that liquidity out. The banks they don't even care about you. They might give you an unsecured overdraft at some insulting interest rate, or they want you to put your home up as collateral for a business. And it's just nonsense. And admittedly, the banks are working to their mandates that have been set for them. So unless the Reserve Bank's going to do something about that, they're just playing by the rules that the Reserve Bank has set. But we've got to work out how we can smooth out the business cash flow. One of the things that is the greatest pressure on small businesses is provisional tax payments. They come at the wrong time. And it's sort of it's normally within a couple of weeks. If you just could keep that money back in your bank account for a little bit longer, you could take advantage of something. So there's actually a new product that I have had the benefit of being across in as it's been built, and that's this product called Taxi.
I have heard of them, yep.
Right, so what people don't know about provisional tax is...
Can you explain in 10 words or less what provisional tax is?
Yeah, so the IRD, you make a profit each year and you have to pay tax on that profit. And the IRD, in all their wisdom, said, look, it's going to be hard for you to come up with a big amount of tax at the end of the year, so we'll get you to pay it in advance, in theory, as you're earning it over the course of the year. So instead of having one big bill that will stress you out, we'll make it four smaller, manageable bills, which basically just has created four stress points.
It's coming up soon. It's coming up.
It's relentless. It's relentless. And it is to force you so that you've always paid your tax. I get that. But what people don't realise is when you make those provisional tax payments, the IRD doesn't get that money. You pay it to the IRD, but it sits in a trust account. And the reason it does that is you haven't actually completed the tax return that says how much tax you have to pay for them to deduct the provisional tax against it. You're not going to do that to the start of next year. So you're making these payments in good faith.
Yes.
It's sitting there. They can't use it. You can't use it. And you needed that money normally at some point during the year. It's crazy.
Wow.
And so what Taxi is this app you can use where if you make your tax payment through the Taxi bank account, Taxi is a tax pooling bank account, which is connected to the IRD. Okay. So it's sitting against your tax, but you're able to borrow against that, essentially, if you needed to. And I've had a client...
Oh, so you're essentially getting the money that you've given them, but you can borrow. It's in a roundabout way you've got that money back to use.
That's right. Yep. And it's set up as almost like an overdraft facility. You don't make any applications. It's yours if you want it.
Okay.
And normally you just need it for a little bit, only at a particular point. And if you didn't have to pay them till the end of the year, you could have managed that. An example I had was a cafe owner. She wanted to buy some signs. If she could commit to it on the day that her provisional tax was due, she would have got a $5,000 discount.
Mm.
She didn't commit to it because she wanted to pay her provisional tax, but that meant that she had to pay $5,000 more. She was going to have that money within a month, but not at that particular point. And it was just timing that made it a bad outcome. Whereas this facility meant that she could have done both. Or I had a more ambitious client who wanted to buy a property and was in their due diligence phase, and they needed to come up with a deposit for their home, and they had for this property, sorry. They had paid a $50,000 provisional tax bill, and they were happy to do that because they were expecting their debtors to have paid them so they could then pay the deposit on the property. Sure as eggs, their debtors didn't pay them when it was due. They paid them 2 weeks later. The impact of that is he wasn't able to go unconditional on a property to do with timing. He'd done everything right, but if he could have borrowed the money from the provisional tax payment, he could have paid the deposit. It was only for 2 weeks that he needed it. And I think that's the problem with business is because we don't have access to things to smooth out our cash flow, it's really hard to plan. So some of those facilities become really important.
Interesting.
Also, Kiwis blend their business affairs with their personal affairs, and it just becomes a
mess.
A shambles, And if the business isn't doing well, then you don't pay yourself a salary, and so then you're using credit cards to fund your personal life, and it's just, it is a shambles, and you don't have clarity on anything. So we've got to break that apart. So for our self-employed clients, we've actually, there's sort of extra layers that we've got to go through to account for the volatility in income, that their lifestyle still costs, and we've got to be able to ride out some of those fluctuations.
Mm.
It's harder when you're self-employed. So volatility of outcome always makes it harder, but it means your planning has to be better.
That's right.
Whereas some people conclude, well, I can't plan. So no. That's the exact wrong conclusion.
Yes.
We've got to plan differently because we've got to allow for some of that uncertainty.
Yeah, I see. It's interesting because a lot of people go into self-employed for freedom.
I know.
In a way.
Makes me laugh. It's like, dude, you're more beholden to the man than ever before. It's not just one boss, though. You've got a whole lot of mouths that become your problem. I know.
Funny. In regards to personal finance, how do you make the big financial decisions in your marriage?
Give me an example of a big financial decision.
Buying a home or buying an investment property or even kind of not major but high value decisions like, oh, we want to go on a holiday. How much are we going to spend on a holiday?
Yeah, that can be tricky because one of the reasons couples come apart on money is they don't have the shared financial goals to start with. So they've got different tendencies, they've got different levels of aspirations, sometimes different values around money. And so, again, it just becomes a cluster pretty quickly. Often the person who, normally you've got someone who's more ambitious or wants to do more and someone wants to do less, agreeing on getting some crossover agreement is really important. So it's when I'm working with clients, it's like, well, what can we agree on kind of as a starter? Is it that we want to make sure you've got enough money for your retirement? And some people, you can just agree to these things quite quickly. Yes, of course.
Yes.
Do we want to make sure that your kids, we can help your kids onto the property ladder? That might be an area that could create agreement, but whereas some parents, one might say absolutely, the other one would say no way. So that might be one area of dissension.
Yeah.
Or is it that we agree we want to get you mortgage-free as fast as possible? Or But we've got to work out where the agreements start and kind of into how much detail we can work within.
Okay.
Some people want to spend, like sometimes if your partner is a financial rebel, that can be quite tricky to manage because they probably are shoppers as well.
Okay.
And if they are dreamers as well, so they spend a lot, they don't want to be kind of constrained, and they believe the universe will provide. Like that's just, if you can find that out before you marry them, that's probably the best thing you can find out, because that's a recipe for stress for one of the partners, right?
Okay.
Like this sort of, this belief that it will all end up okay in the end, which I sort of believe for everything, but being okay in the end actually means that no one's going to die from you not doing what you're supposed to do. So you can be okay in the end, but that doesn't mean you're living in a house you like, with a job you enjoy, with kids that are going to thrive financially. You're still okay in
happy.
The end.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I think sometimes we use these flippant comments and
so
you can be skeptical of that. And I think you should be, like, just because there's a belief that you want to be optimistic that it will be fine doesn't mean we shouldn't have a plan, you know, like sort of trust in God but still have life insurance.
Yeah.
know, the two things aren't mutually exclusive.
So true. How do you personally invest, or what do you invest in?
I invest in businesses and I invest in property.
Okay.
And I sort of, you have your share market and all those kind of basics, but I believe in leverage.
Okay.
I try, when I buy my properties, I try and link it to a goal that I'm trying to achieve, so to almost compartmentalise why I'm doing that particular property.
Yep.
So initially it was to make sure that we could retire comfortably, then we kind of tick that box, and so then I want to make sure that my next property might be aimed for my parents. So I want to make sure they have a good retirement. So my focus of the property or the criteria might be different because it's serving that particular purpose. Or more recently, I've wanted my kids to start to own property. So the properties that are appropriate to invest in with them are different than what my husband and I might invest in. But I'm a believer in property because the leveraged impact is undeniable. But you have to have a really strong base to enjoy, to be able to get through a cycle so you enjoy it. So kind of on a day-to-day basis, knowing that I'm a shopper. And I still work with a financial coach, so I've designed the programs for our clients.
Absolutely. Ah.
Because to get the best out of me, I need to be accountable. Like the problem with me with money is I don't care about money.
Yep.
I want to have enough to not care.
Yes.
And when
I understand that.
So then I'm quite relaxed. I don't kind of go out and spend, but I'm just super relaxed. Money never is something that I worry about because I've got that base.
Yeah, cool.
And so for me, that's what financial success is. But, yeah, I guess the knowledge that I could stop work today and not have to work is a pretty cool feeling.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But that's because you create the wealth that gives you the options to entertain that.
Definitely. What's the – obviously – the accounting side of things. What's the other interest in buying businesses?
More so investing in businesses.
I'm just
good at business, so I know how to grow business.
You know it.
It's
live and breathe
to me. I find that fun. I love the chasing of the deal of a business, and it's just something that I feel very comfortable with.
Yeah, nice. What's the biggest money mistake you've made or regret?
I was thinking about regrets last week. I had to ask my mum, I'm like, what have I done wrong? She's pretty quick to list the things.
Pretty on.
I think in business, I think sometimes when you're it's often the wrestle between your personal values and business values has been hard. You know, like for example, a business, you might need to make some changes in your business for the viability of your business. So you might need to shut down a particular product line. Well, that impacts people who are working on that product line. So you're trying to redeploy them into the business, or if you can't, you've got to let them go.
Yeah.
Well, you really like those people. You have invested in them. You have walked arm in arm at different points. You care for them. And that process is quite hard to go through. And you're trying to balance, because the impact is if you don't make some of those hard calls, and that's the thing about hard things, is hard things are hard things.
Yep.
If you don't make those calls, then you run the risk of destabilizing the rest of the business.
And then everyone else.
And then everyone can be destabilized by that. So I think my biggest regret is when I know that there is sort of that conflict, I don't want to make the decision as quickly as what I should.
Yeah.
And so you hold on for longer and you try and give certainty for longer. And I'm not convinced that that serves anyone well, but at least you don't feel like you've been mean. But that no one appreciates it anyway. They still hate you. But those are things that I've found hard. But at the end of the day, you've got to be able to live with yourself and know that you have done everything to stand for whatever
that's right.
The concept is. So.
Yeah, because you would have gone through every scenario before you.
Yeah, you've held on for as long as possible. Yep. But I just think you've got different stakeholders which can make it hard. And I think sometimes you're prepared to take a personal hit because you can. And sometimes it can be easier if, you know, like that's at the expense of your family possibly, you know. And so some people can give more of themselves but at the expense of other things. And I think that's not fair to the other things as well. But how do they get a voice at the table when they're kind of not directly involved in anything?
In regards to career, what's the best thing about being in financial services?
Well, I think helping people is satisfying. Making money is fun.
Yes.
And helping your clients make money,
change
their lives is probably one of the most powerful things you can do.
Yeah, it is.
I think there's a saying by C.S. Lewis, I think. I can't change the beginning, but I can change your ending. And that's what I feel that my calling is for the people that I work
Very
with.
Cool.
And it does feel like a calling.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. What's the what does the future look like for Enable Me?
Well, my objective, don't know if it's a business objective or a personal objective. Well, business-wise, I'd like to see if I can take it into Australia and have a bit of fun with that.
Yeah.
From a personal side, I would like to be able to democratize financial advice more and to help people who are struggling to survive get better with money, because you can't talk about thriving when you're surviving, you know. And the tools needed for that group is very, very different. And if I can do something to help them from a kind of a beliefs, personal beliefs and values, I'd like to. And I've always thought that if we can narrow the gap between rich and poor, not by bringing the rich down, but by lifting the poor up.
Yeah,
I think that we could create an amazing country where people have hope for their financial future. And I think the problem with where a lot of the economy is at now is a lot of people don't have hope anymore.
Yeah,
and that's dangerous.
Yeah,
that's dangerous for families, generations, legacies. That's dangerous. And it can create a really negative mindset, which then perpetuates the fact that you'll never get ahead. I'm like, well, that's not the way to think about it, but I can see why people do think about it that way.
Yeah, cool. That's really cool. And finally, what does wealth look like to you?
Having options. I think some people feel wealthy. Well, if we're talking about financial wealth, I mean, the ultimate wealth would be to know that your family's okay, that your soul's okay, that some of those bigger beliefs, your health's okay. That's probably wealth, It's just money can enable that, right? Like, it's satisfying to know you've got money that you can help your kids get the education you want to give them. Mm. That takes money. Or that you can live yep. in a warm house. That takes money. Or to know that you could stop work tomorrow because your living costs are so small because you've paid off your mortgage. Well, those things are just options. And I think wealth just creates options for you and your family.
Awesome. Well, Hannah, thank you so much for coming on the Fresh Money Podcast. Yeah, had so many pearls of wisdom in there, and yeah, just really appreciate your time.
Thank you.